So, I mean, there's what can I say? Something like. Like activism, you know. And that's kind of like web pages. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like pre 1996 or so. It would be like ecological, an example there would be the East Timor campaign.
To go back to these web pages, where were they? Where was this server?
Yeah, so this was probably like hosted in internet service providers, like old ISP dial-up. Yeah. Dial-up, don't 1L, yeah, dial-up. Dial-up hosting, you know, where they used to give you a few megabytes along with your dial-up account. Mm. I mean, this was Greenpeace, and et al. Greenpeace actually had some internet-looking infrastructure before there was internet as such. They were one of the first groups that I saw that had internet, or not internet, but internet-working. They kind of had internal email.
Were you involved in working on that infrastructure?
Not really, no. I mean, I was, as a teenager, I was interested in Greenpeace, I suppose. I thought it was cool to get in an inflatable thing and go and like float around the seas. So I never did that, but of course it's not as romantic as it sounds when I think when you get there. But the Greenpeace people had a lot of professional support for their networking, and they didn't really let, like, you know, random activist people who turned up in the office kind of have access to their networks. The high-ranking officials in Greenpeace had special computers with modems that they could dial up, and they were dialing into a central office in Amsterdam to get their emails and that kind of thing. Pretty secretive organization at the time, actually. Then, I mean, that was in Ireland. Greenpeace then in Ireland was shut down, and there was a lot of some internal strife over that I never really had that much interest in. So the servers that was, yeah, I don't know if Greenpeace had server pages. I mean, but I guess for me, like, even previous to like this part, I was also doing FidoNet. And that was hosted at home, really. There was an organization in Dublin called Connect Ireland, and they were a relay for me. So I would phone them up in the nighttime and pass the email to them, and then they would handle the international phone calls to, I think, Paris and wherever they would call and transfer mailblocks. So that's how FidoNet worked. So that was around, I mean, I don't remember when I brought up the FidoNet node, but it might have been 1992. or three, maybe. It's probably listed somewhere on the internet. I think my name is still on the node. FidoNet still exists, but one of the requirements of having a FidoNet node was you had to put your real name on it.
Who was using FidoNet?
Everybody. I mean, well, everybody who had a modem and had a computer and who was connected to the bulletin board system. It was linked to BBSs, which was a little bit of a different scene in Europe, maybe, to what was happening in the United States. So in the BBS scene in the United States was a little bit more associated with this hacker culture of people who were breaking into the telco systems. Well, not really breaking into them, because at that time the telco people hadn't even figured out the concept of a password. Everything was just, you either knew the phone number or you didn't. If you knew the phone number, you dialed into the system. As you dialed into the system, you got access, got like a command prompt on their AT&T systems. It's how I understand it anyway. And so they used to be able to do things, figure them out, and then like reroute different phone numbers, and there was stuff like that. I think people were having fun, but then it all got quite serious as people started to get prosecuted under their laws and for, you know, things like trafficking data across state lines or something like that. But yeah, in Europe, the BBS system was just people, people with interests, hobbyists who would at the weekend dial up other systems and see if they had some files, maybe documents, newspapers, or pictures, the interesting stuff that you could download. And at the time, I guess it could take anything from maybe 5 to 10 minutes to download a decent high-resolution picture. There were also programs and some open-source stuff that was floating around. But FidoNet was really just discussion boards, a little bit like today's news groups or mailing lists, where people would log in, download the mail, and then spend a few hours maybe reading through it, and then maybe compose a reply.
Preparing something for sending.
Yeah, you would prepare it offline for sending, and then maybe, you know, I remember at that time phone calls were very expensive, so especially during the day, weekdays during the day, it was really prohibitive to dial up a data system because everything took so long. But you didn't want to do that, so we made the phone calls at night or at the weekend when the system was cheaper.
And who paid your bill?
A friend of mine, really. I mean, most of this was happening in his house, and he had a job. It wasn't a big deal. He also bought the computers. I still have the first 500 megabyte hard disk that we bought, and I think that cost something like 400 Irish pounds at the time, which was rather a lot of money for 500 megabytes. We also had to eventually rent another phone line because we had people dialing into our system. We used to try to share the phone line with voice calls, and that was a bit difficult. You know, you'd pick up the phone and go, oh, it's a data call, turn on the modem really quickly, and then you'd try to hang it up and try to get the modem to connect before it would freak out. And
it's like, bye, human.
Where people would misunderstand if you left the system on during the night and they'd call up for some reason and go, oh, the phone is not working, there's some terrible noise. But that was an interesting thing, I suppose, about the dynamic of FidoNet was that it was a high latency network. So, you know, there wasn't this kind of, sometimes mailing lists, you know, you write a response and then people can come back really quickly, you know, within minutes at you with something. And then there's this sense of that you have to respond. And, you know, if you would only connect online at the weekend, write your articles or your opinions or response pieces and then go away for a week. When you came back after a week, there would be maybe an enormous amount of conversation that had gone on in the meantime, where it's quite possible that you might have become demonized or something in that. And it's interesting that I saw that reflected in concerns of parents that I know over the last few years, where kids, especially around the age 13 to 14, 15, were disabling their Facebook accounts in the morning time when they would leave home because they weren't allowed to have devices or be online in school. And they would just, the reason why they disabled the account was that so that nobody else could tag, like, comment on anything that belonged to them while they were offline. And then they would go, when they got home, they would, it's usually like do the homework before you can get on the computer. So they would do that, and then they'd get on, and then they'd unblock their Facebook account, and then the stuff would start coming in. You know, it's like, na-na-na-na-na, I feel you, na-na-na-na,
you know.
Yeah, but they could react in real time with it, so they could defend themselves. Mm-hmm. So this online bullying that was going on, they say, did you see that stupid T-shirt that they had on the school today? Look at this picture I took. And then they were able to, you know, either, you know, de-tag themselves maybe in posts that were not nice. And, you know, it's kind of silly kid stuff going on. But yeah, that was... You know, it's interesting that kids actually started doing that with Facebook. They're saying, I don't want it to be able to go on without me. And yeah, and so that also generated this a lot of stress where you know, people who, I think some of the kids who hadn't figured that out were very like, I need to get online because I don't know what they're saying about me. Anyway, that's much more forward than 1992-93. At some point, I suppose this thing that goes into a little bit like this grassroots media organizations that really grew up around the Seattle WTO protests, which I was 1999, is it? I don't remember. I've been meaning to look it up, but I do try to resist looking up information.
Is that the beginning of Rise Up also?
I don't know when Rise Up was actually began as a thing, but there's kind of grassroots media organizations that kind of invented more or less two things. They kind of invented video publishing as a thing, and they invented peer review, which nearly any, I think all major media outlets nowadays have a comment section. You know, you're the internet user, you have the right to write a comment, and then some of them are moderated, some of them aren't, but it was these grassroots media organizations that grew up from the Seattle WTO protests that kind of invented that peer review idea. Video publishing and open publishing, I suppose. Open publishing of that. And so where was all that hosted? I don't know. I mean, there were some people who had access to stuff at the time. I'm really not sure who they were or how, but some of that got hosted.
What did you do in there?
With this?
Yeah.
You know, some tech stuff and development, I suppose. Just I was interested in those. The time learning a little bit from these kinds of static web pages that we had in the mid-90s, with where organizations would just put some kind of information up about what was happening with their campaign, but it wasn't always easy for people who were working in the offices to be able to update any of that, because we didn't really have content management systems. There were no blogs. There was the so-called Web 2.0 thing, which is a little bit, you know, what this, like, so-called 2.0 is a little bit what this created, was, you know, that idea that the user of the internet is the content contributor, which of course has led us a little bit to where we are now. I mean, I suppose actually in the meantime here, at some point for me, growing out of the work with FidoNet and BBS and dial-up modems, then I got interested in TCP/IP, and at some point, definitely before, I think maybe around 96, that I took a desktop computer on a plane to a place in England, somewhere near the Sheriff of Nottingham, I think. Somewhere in Robin Hood territory, and left it in a data center up there. It plugged into a cable, and that was the first time that I had something that I was fully in control of, kind of on the internet, connected to a reasonably fast pipe. And so then I offered people hosting on that, you know, like small, again, mostly static web page stuff where people would design their own web pages. Remember, people even used to do it in Microsoft Word, and then you would go save as HTML, and that would create this awful, horrible HTML that was really difficult to edit by hand.
How was it economically viable? Did you pay for the
Yeah, we paid for the hosting. It wasn't that expensive. Actually, there's still there's still one of those machines is still there. No, I lie. It's not the guy who actually paid for that took out a fully dedicated server in Iraq in another company in the same town, I think, in the same area. Because eventually that server died, which was quite interesting. Because before we went there on the plane, we actually mailed them a server. And once it got there and it was online, everything was fine. And then it started crashing, and we had to call up support and ask them to reset it, a full hard power reset. And my colleague, I remember saying to me, he said, "I think it's something wrong with it, you know, physically." And I said, "That's really strange." And he said, "No, but what about maybe if that CPU fan fell off the CPU?" And I said, "You really think so? It was on pretty tight." And then the two of us took a cheap flight over to Sheriff of Nottingham Land, and we went into the data center and pulled it out. And sure enough, the CPU fan had actually fallen off the thing, and we had brought the new server with us anyway. We said, "Look, let's just build a new one and take it with us and swap it out." And that's what we did, and that machine sat there for quite a long time.
And who was being served? Like, who were you serving?
So I kind of opened it up to anybody. I mean, there was a friend of mine who was doing sail training services on a boat, and he had some space there. There was a guy in Ireland called Tom Hyland who used to be a bus conductor. Remember the days of bus conductors? And when you used to be somebody on the bus who would charge you the money, you'd get on the bus, and then they had these machines that you'd go and the ticket would come out.
I think they did it in Belgium.
Really?
Pay to the driver.
Pay to the driver. Yeah, I mean, there was pay to driver buses, but I mean, you've probably seen the famous London bus with the get on at the back. So they had some of those, of course, in Ireland, because Ireland copied the UK and everything, and I think that's where maybe the bus conductor idea came from. And the driver was often sealed off in a complete in another bit. They had their own door to get in. Anyway, Tom was a bus conductor, and he's a great, really great guy. But he lost it one day on the bus, and somebody paid in like pennies, you know. And he was saying, he threw them on the floor or something. I got a little bit reprimanded. But around the same time, he saw that video of the cemetery massacre in East Timor. That I don't remember what kind of year that came out, but it was a video that got smuggled out into Australia, I think, of something. And before that, nobody really knew what was going on in East Timor. And he said, "I need to stop being a bus conductor, and I need to get this going." And he was actually completely instrumental. I mean, I think he was made an honorary citizen of East Timor when they got their independence, and I think he went to live there for a while. I have no idea where he is now, but that was kind of one of his central activism groups that sort of kicked off hosting. And there were a few people, like everybody knew Tom then, because he was a big figure, and he was friends with some of the people in the Irish Senate. And
so was he hosting videos on your server?
Not really hosting videos at that point. I mean, we didn't really have online video capability at all. There was no speed for it, and nobody had video cameras. We didn't really have the possibility to encode video. I mean, real media and the real media server came along somewhere at the point of around 1999.
Yeah, that's his company, yeah? Not Real Media, but Real Media, the Real Player.
Yeah, Real Player.
Which is a kind of a compression. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah, they were there. That was probably mostly used at the for this Seattle video streaming and video upload stuff, where there was kind of first time activists in the street actually went out with cameras and filmed, you know, cops doing cop stuff in the street, the protests, and put it on the internet, and you could watch it. I was very small, but you could stream it on a slow connection. Yeah, like really small. I don't know what they were, like 120 by 80 or something like that, you know, in terms of the resolution. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, if it's good content, you can see what's going on. So yeah, sorry, I could go on, rant on a little bit about the East Timor thing, but when Greenpeace shut down, there was an agreement that they would fund a new Irish environmental organization. The split in Greenpeace was over whether or not it should be local or global, and the Greenpeace International wanted to focus on global campaigns, and the Irish office said, well, I mean, all of our Irish membership didn't sign up to Greenpeace to have you only work on the nuclear issue, so they're concerned about local issues and we don't want to abandon that membership. And the agreement was, well, we'll ask their membership, they can have a choice, they can stay with Greenpeace International or they can join the new local organization. So Greenpeace gave some money to the ex-Greenpeace people in Ireland, and they started up something called Voice of Irish Concern for the Environment, which is kind of what do you call those things? It's an acronym that fits in itself.
I was thinking, what will it become? But Voice becomes Voice.
Yeah. Yeah, Voice of Irish Concern for the Environment. And they were around for a while, and I did some work with them. And I'm not sure how that worked out with hosting. I might have hosted them for a little while on some of these servers. And, you know, whoever was around, it wasn't... just generally friends and people and, you know, whoever. West Papua, of course, was also a campaign that was, I suppose, somewhat linked with the East Timor campaign, something that I never really knew that much about myself, but there was a guy who was quite instrumental in that campaign, and he had some space on the server for a while. Of course, all of these groups eventually left that server for the main reason that they all wanted their own top-level domain name. They preferred to be mycampaign.org rather than mycampaign.yourhost.org. And that was a bit of a point of contention, because I've really felt like I had actually put quite a lot of personal time and energy into creating this hosting situation for them. And once the hosting prices came down, they just said, "Ah, we can afford this now. We don't need you anymore. Thanks very much for all your time and work." And I mean, I suppose it's normal, you know, but that's something that happened. So I don't know. Hosting, you wanted.
No, I think we know, I know a little bit about your trajectory now, but only what I've read. So we were wondering what was the history before, and I think it could be interesting to also talk about your work now, and how long have you been doing it, and why are you doing it, etc.
Okay. So the main work now is on these mobile networks in poorly served regions of principally Mexico. We're also looking at getting that to happen in other countries. There's a project in Colombia, for example, which is quite interesting because it's based in the zone where the ceasefire is playing out at the moment between the ex-FARC people and their process, which I'm not very familiar. I don't really study the history of Colombia, but I think most people are somewhat familiar with the tragedy of that long conflict there, long armed conflict that really affected a lot of people. And so I was really privileged to be able to go and visit that region and see how what the importance last year of communications and projects that actually bring these communities together, so that the ex-combatants who have now 100% like really seriously said no to armed conflict can re-engage with the communities that were so badly affected by their operations, and of course just as much, if not even more so, by the state response with the military might of the Colombian army.
Can you say something of how that infrastructure is being built and how it's being done?
Well, it's kind of grassroots organization, I suppose, initiatives from the community who said, oh, you know, maybe we'd like to do something. Like, we have terrible mobile phone coverage in the region, and then they heard about our project and said, you know, maybe we can do a mobile phone project in Colombia and build mobile towers so that people can have a network that is running within their communities and they can use phones there. Most of the places that I was in, there was some kind of a mobile phone coverage, where if you went to the highest point of the community and held your arm out, you could get a signal, and then you could kind of make the call and talk to somebody for a bit. Or a lot of people actually had big Yagi antennas on their houses, and actually some people in those communities are kind of making a living out of that by selling phone call time to other people. So they have a kind of a number of public phones that are not really public phones, they're just somebody's private phone, but you go there and you make a phone call and then you give them whatever for how long you were talking. So
And did you make this organization?
I wasn't terribly instrumental in the making of the organization. It was a technical thing for me that came out of a conversation where a colleague in Rizomatica, his name is Peter Bloom, who would be the founder, I suppose, of Rizomatica, if you like. Peter told me one night over glass of mezcal that there was this possibility to make a mobile phone tower from a small device called a software-defined radio, and that there was a piece of software called OpenBTS that facilitated this, that had been written by these guys in the United States, and they were using it at the Burning Man festival to make GSM networks there for test purposes. I think it's the only place they were able to actually get a license to do this. I thought that was interesting because it's a Burning Man. I don't know, I've never been there, but I'd heard about it, and it seemed like, why would you want to bring that kind of tech into Burning Man? But I was interested in that because I had some experience of the lack of communication in rural areas in Mexico. And a lot of people have VHF radio systems where they have some kind of powerful central transmitter in a village, and then everybody has small radio handsets. And those small radio handsets, okay, they're a lot cheaper now than they used to be. You can buy some Chinese models with all kinds of VHF system.
Is that what Martin is working on?
Yeah, there's something like that. That might be specifically a marine VHF radio that he has, or maybe it's just an all bands. I mean, those kinds of things, 10 years ago, it wasn't that easy, maybe 10, to get them. There were a few models around, but they did run into the hundreds of dollars, euros, pounds, whatever. This idea that people could use these almost redundant devices that they have, like all these kinds of old, even there's lots of still old Nokia phones around that the batteries still work great on them, and they last a long time and they work well, that people would be able to use these things in the community without the requirement to get to build a VHF infrastructure and have radios, and also that just general people can use them, because not everybody's comfortable with VHF or with, you know, push-to-talk radios. You'd think that it would be, but people are sometimes confused by that, you know, just even getting used to the push-to-talk thing, and then that you have to let go of the button and listen, and then if you have more than, if you have a few people using the channels at the same time, it can get a little bit confusing. And the technology, of course, takes care of all of that for you with a GSM network, because you don't have to sort of wait till the channel is clear and then transmit and ask, is this person there? It handles it for you and says, okay, you can have this channel. And so I thought that was a nice idea, and started talking a little bit more with Peter about it. And then through a friend of mine, had an art residency in the Turku Peninsula, actually, a thing called Contemporary Art Archipelago. And because of the connection with Finland and Nokia, and that she had a project called Mejor Vida Corporation, which is like Better Life Corporation, which is still an ongoing project. And I sort of, after this, she was maybe a little bit thinking about what to do with the at the CAA in Finland. And this idea came up and said, well, why doesn't like Mejor Vida Corporation, Mejor Vida Corporation's like corporate logo slogan is yes, it's free. So I said, why don't we do yes, it's free mobile calls? And so that allowed us to advance, to get resources and time to advance that a little bit. And then that equipment got taken to the villages in the mountains of Mexico, where we had initial conversations with people there. And there's something about being able to actually demonstrate it, that it works, that you're not talking through whatever. Yeah. In Ireland, we have a slightly less polite, common way of saying something like that. But
just to be like the we that you're speaking about.
I suppose at that point,
900 megahertz or 1800 megahertz.
Yeah, it is. So the we in this project is, I suppose, myself and Peter Bloom. There's a really, really good telecommunications lawyer called Eric Huerta, who's based in Mexico City, who did some really stunning work on eventually getting us permission to be able to use the frequencies, because this is this highly contended band that's used for mobile telephony that the mobile providers generally hold on to and won't let you use it at all. Even, you know, the mobile providers and the state regulatory bodies that handle this stuff. So we then includes the indigenous communities that we were in initial discussions with, and most of them, well, most, there wasn't that many, but let me say most anyway, had a community radio initiative, some kind of FM broadcast initiative where they had some kind of local community radio. And they thought it would be interesting that they could have some way for the listeners in the radio to be able to feed back to the radio station, and thought, well, if they could send text messages or call in or something like that, it would be nice. So it was built as an extension of the FM broadcast community radio idea. And the key point in it being that some of these communities had written letters to the incumbent largest of the mobile operators in Mexico, certainly probably the Americas, and said, look, we would really like to have mobile phone service in our community, please. And the company had written back and said, well, we can only really do that if you can guarantee us that you have like this number of people who are going to be resident there, who are going to buy at least X amount of prepaid credit per month or whatever. And basically they were saying, sorry, you're too poor, go away. So, and it's understandable, because at that time, the cost of bringing like all tower infrastructure into those kinds of regions and securing it and supplying power for it, you might probably need solar backup, as the region up there gets hit by a lot of electricity storms lightning storms, electrical storms in the rainy season, and it takes its toll on electrical equipment that's there. Also, power goes out a lot, so you need an autonomous power supply if you want to have something like that. And just the whole cost of a tower was actually placed somewhere in the region of around $250,000 just for one tower. That's what it was costing mobile operators to install a mobile tower at the time. Of course, they were using all this proprietary equipment for GSM networks that is only ever produced by a small number of companies that sort of had a monopoly on that. So that drove the cost up as well. So,
can you repeat the name of the organization again, because I missed that?
Our organization is called Rhizomatica. That's what Peter came up with the name. It comes from the idea of the rhizome, of the plant that will find its, whether will, you know, you can chop off one part of it and it will find another way to reconnect. Those kind of roots and networks and stuff. So I suppose, you know, Peter started looking at the economics of the situation and saying, okay, so if you have a community of 2,000 families and they can only afford this amount per month for their telephony, what does that give you in terms of a budget over, say, a year, and what the community might be able to pay back, and looked at ways to be able to install that in the community and make it economically sustainable. And with that in mind, eventually went along with Eric Huerta to talk to the Mexican Ministry for Communications, and we were expecting to be run out of the country, taken to the airport and thrown, put on the next plane and said thank you very much. But it actually wasn't like that at all, because they just had an OECD report, I think, on their table, which was criticizing Mexico for lack of penetration to rural communities of mobile coverage. Of course, that was all about like things like internet banking and this kind of stuff that they want to roll out. But they were sort of interested, because they said, oh, you know, we have this problem here, and that these big operators, they don't want to go and cover these rural zones that will cost them money, and we're wondering how to deal with that. And then you turn up and you tell us that you want to do this, and you don't even want us to pay you. You just want us to give you permission to do it. And we said, let's think about that. So it kind of worked out eventually that these between Eric and some possibly forward-thinking people in the Mexican ministries, they came up with this idea that yes, mobile phone operations could work on a non-profit basis, and that there is no reason why radio spectrum could not be used in an area where it's completely free anyway, because there isn't a tower for miles. So there's some restrictions that they put on it, which I think are somewhat imposed by the industry. It has to be predominantly indigenous population. There's not allowed to be another operator in the region. And eventually they gave Rizomatic... Well, actually, Rizomatica created another organization in Mexico, which is called Telecomunicaciones Indígenas Comunitarias. That would be community... indigenous telecommunications, and that organization was the one that was given officially the concession from the state to operate, which is nice, because it means that when a new community wants to join, they don't have to go through the bureaucratic process of actually applying for access to the frequency, because TIC can already give them that. And it also means that TIC is actually a collective assembly-based organization that involves all the communities. So when a community wants to join the community telecoms network, they have to come into the collective and take part in the assemblies and take on a responsibility to have collective management of the network. So that ensures that it remains completely community run and owned and administered. So that's kind of what's going on there.
And what was this, like, if you can compare it to cooking, like, what was your role in the kitchen?
Oh.
Or Rizomatica.
Yeah, so it's a highly technical area, just to getting all that stuff to work. The so-called 2G stack, this... all of the components of a GSM network that have been mostly replicated in open source software, particularly by this Osmocom group that are mostly based in Germany. Osmocom's open source mobile communications. They just people who are interested in hacking on all kinds of mobile stuff. And they had put together most of these components at but a lot of it still needed a lot of work, and then you have to mix it in with an administration system that allows people to add credit to phones for making long-distance calls, and you know, all of the just different kind of monitoring and lots of problems that came up. So my part in cooking all that up was really, really technical, and I think that one of the things that's actually been really problematic is finding good technical people in Latin America, because they tend to come from a privileged background, which has enabled them to have a university education, and then just because of the way that kind of gets pushed, they tend to get headhunted if they're any good into companies that do not do non-profit work, and or they tend to get headhunted to the United States, because yeah, the United States has a policy of looking around the world to find anybody who's any good at anything and bringing them into the United States to remove them from.
As a side note, I don't know if you know Barefoot College in India, where rural women are taught how to make solar panels.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's only women from villages.
Right. And do they do those solar panels get used then by the same communities?
Yeah. Okay. So they do micro economic interventions. So the woman sells a service, teaches someone else, etc., etc.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's often you don't have to be able to read to be able to be part of the project.
Okay.
You really just have to come from a village.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe also to wrap up now, because I think also I don't want to eat the whole, because the day will fly by.
Yeah, yeah, we can talk for hours if you like.
I think you already said a lot about why, like why it feels important to work on the side of hosting services to others, and especially in the example of Mexico. Can you add anything as a sort of last question of what are your like coming from a long trajectory in Europe with different networks, and you were very personally involved in running those networks, and now going to somewhere else, trying to build different kind of networks, but with similar purposes, it seems. In empowering certain groups to share information, to share or be in contact with each other. So I'm trying to hint at something of the why question.
Sure. I think for me that it was, you know, back early in the early days when my friend of mine bought the first 2400 baud modem or something, and we connected to BPSs and so like digital information, and that, you know, we would dial up something in Ireland, but though they had files that they had downloaded from somewhere, something in some other place, and it's like, oh, you know, there's something nice about this freedom of access. I don't like these words anymore. It sounds like freedom of information or freedom of access to information. But, you know, there was this kind of new thing. And I suppose maybe as a somewhat naive late teenager, early 20s person, I thought, this is the answer. This is what we need as a planet, as a species, to somehow overcome all of this weird kind of what to me at the time seemed like a weird sort of, you know, people had a lot of opinions and some of them hold them really strongly, you know, people are even willing to die for their opinions or some stupid stuff like that, you know. No disrespect to the people who choose to do that, of course, but you know, it's a strange world where you have all this different stuff, and it seemed I was interested in finding what's real, what's true, what's actually going on here. And, you know, of course, it's been a long journey in discovering that, you know, wherever you go, wherever you're talking to humans, people, there's always going to be opinion and what they've learned and what they've been told by other people and how all of that works. And, of course, there's massive power involved in being able to influence any of that. And that's how we've seen networks go in recent times. They've become more and more tools to reach the masses, like radio and television did. So, but I still think that we have to try to do it. I mean, being incommunicated is a very difficult thing when you can't get information on anything, you're in a position of serious disadvantage. And so it seems to me obvious that we have to make efforts to at least allow people to communicate with each other. I mean, when you need something, the usual best way to solve that problem is to ask somebody else. You know, it's like, do you know the way to get to the station? And it's like, oh yes, it's down there. Oh, great, problem solved. You know, and if you don't have the language when you're in a strange city or something like that, and you can't speak to people, it's really much harder. You know, you end up having to find the one person who can speak your language, or try to find a map somewhere, decipher it. And, you know, as you know,
if there are maps.
If there are maps, yeah. Yes.
Could be that go around the corner of the next river. And anyway, I have two more questions. One is the emphasis on telephony, whilst the conversation here is the internet is already dead, whilst certain regions are still focusing on telephony. So this or will there, is there a transition? So that's one thing I would ask.
Yeah, sure. I mean, take that slightly technically, just to say something. I'm not a telco engineer. I haven't worked in that stuff, but I was. One point, I had a temporary job in London at some point, which involved going into these old telephone exchanges with these wires everywhere and cabinets of things going as they would dial up numbers physically. But telco world has its own thing, and I think nowadays actually the telcos are the main people that are involved in internet infrastructure. I mean, they're the people who had all the wires that we now move the data over, and when you make phone calls someplace, you never really know what network that phone call is going over. There might be sections of it that are traveling along exactly the same fiber lines as your data. In fact, you know, most people have a DSL or some kind of connection at home still that's using the same wires as their telephone, and people just don't really use the telephone anymore.
I meant in the Mexican.
So the reason for saying that, all of that stuff about the telcos, is that it's kind of one in the same. Like, Rizomatica is using internet connections to send voice traffic to the PSTN network, because we don't have really any other choice. So within the community, there was one particular first goal, which was to establish voice communications person to person within the village. The village can be totally isolated from the outside world. It maybe has solar power, but people can call each other. And there were some interesting examples of how they used that in some places. You know, they had a small kind of micro taxi service that was enabled by that, because the entrance road into the community was a bit too much for the local buses that would take people up there from the city, especially in the rainy season. They didn't like to take the buses down there because they might get stuck. So people who would arrive from the city with heavy things or something like that would have to try to pre-arrange with somebody else to be able to go and collect them. But because the bus arrival time could have a variancy of 2 hours either side of the timetable time, or maybe not arrive at all, it was very difficult for them to be able to do that. You know, in some cases, they could, you know, have people who look out and might see the bus coming up the road and say, oh, they'll be here in about 20 minutes, we'd better go up. But the local call system allowed them to just get off the bus and connect to the local mobile network and say, hey, I'm here. Or even, you know, a few minutes before, when they would get into range of the antenna, they could call people up and say, the bus will be here 5 minutes, can you come up in the moto taxi and drive me down with my shopping? And that was also kind of enabler for a small local economy where people could charge a few pesos for this service. There was also something that we talked about, and which is also talked about in terms of communication networks in the Amazon, which is emergency medical care. And we did have a case of somebody being bitten out in the countryside by something nasty. I haven't been able to actually really get what it was. I don't know if it was a snake or something, but and they were able to call into the village for medical care. The thing is that a lot of these places, they have a line of sight to where the people are working, and there are cornfields or something like that. So it's not actually, the distance is not that far. It might only be 5 kilometers or something like that from the antenna to where the person is. So you have no problem doing mobile coverage. But for a human to walk from the village to there, they have to go down into a valley and round and find the bit where you can get over the river and then call up the other side of the valley. So it can take them 2 to 3 hours to actually walk to the other side of the valley. And you know, there's simple things like, hey, I forgot my whatever it is. If you're coming over in the afternoon, can you please bring it? Which otherwise, you know, they would have to resort to some kind of smoke signals or something to be able to do that. So there was a lot of community day-to-day life that was facilitated by simply having voice communications. And of course, for these people, they have a lot of family members that have migrated out of these villages, and they live in the cities, or a lot of them live in the United States. And so for them to be able to simply call those numbers up and talk to their family members is also something that they really appreciate. And so there are lots to be done with just voice calls. And of course, they have SMS message capability on the local network as well. But a lot of people in these communities, even though they're quite poor, you'd be surprised to see the amount of fancy smartphones that they have. And this is partly due to presents coming back from emigrants to United States or somewhere where they would send them back with some iPhone 6 or something. It's like, hey, and, and so people have these things, and they say, hey, I want, can we have data on this network? You know, it's like, when I go to the city, I have my data, and I can use Facebook and WhatsApp and all of this stuff. And our 2G open source mobile network doesn't really quite support that stuff yet. You can have, do a very slow data connection. It's a little bit unreliable. You could possibly do some kind of instant messaging. But I also feel that I don't... that this is an area where it's much, much more intrusive, and maybe we can kind of wrap it up here and leave this for another episode, where you start talking about the predatory aspect of today's internet, where people who are interested in amassing a large amount of power, mainly with a profit-making motive, have discovered that these networks can be used to influence the behavior of other people, which is, I think we're currently referring to that as behavior modification. Jaron Lanier has a nice acronym for the word bummer, which is behavior of users modified and made into an empire for rent. So, you know, maybe I can just leave it there with that little quote from Lanier.
Yeah, the only thing I was, the second one I had was the metals.
Yeah?
Yeah, so for future strategies, resilience and sustainability, for example, financial.
So what's the question, really?
The question is like, these nodes need entretien, onderhoud, maintenance. Yeah, and they cost money, and how will it go on?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the most important thing to say about that is that there was a nice workshop here this week where people were talking about being careful of some words such as sovereignty, autonomy, freedom, these kinds of things, and having a look at how these words can be romanticized a little bit. And I think that, you know, we could say, oh, Rizomatica creates autonomous community-controlled networks by buying some Chinese electronics in a sealed black box that we put on a tower, and then if the lightning hits it and it stops working, they don't really have much choice but to take it down from the tower and send it back to the Chinese factory, where they'll look at it and go, no, that's trash, here's another one. There's not really an awful lot you can do with this kind of microcircuitry to fix it, or to be able to even diagnose problems with it without high-tech equipment such as reflow ovens and stuff like that, you know, and all kinds of scopes, and it's expensive testing and repair equipment. So that's something that we're not really looking at right now in Rizomatica, because we don't have a way to, you know, create a school for teaching people how to do local electronics repair in this region. It's something that's, I think, a little bit out of the scope of the project for the moment, but that doesn't mean that it's not very present in the minds of people, in this idea that there's an enormous amount of hypocrisy involved in claiming that you're building an autonomous network when you're actually using components that are mined from the same kind of communities that you profess to be helping by creating wars and conflicts over resource extraction that gets used to build electronics that then create base stations that then get bought and put up on towers and people talk on phones. So what we have done is managed to sort of say, okay, that's the situation, we'll just accept it as it is. And oh, let me say, I read something really nice about hypocrisy the other day, which was from this guy Mark Boyle, who's living out in the west of Ireland without tech. And he said that hypocrisy is it just means that I have set higher standards for myself higher than those which I can currently personally achieve. You know, which is kind of it's a nice way, because it's very easy for people to like point fingers at you and say, hey, hypocrite. And you say, no, I'm just, this is my goal. Obviously, I'm not there yet, but I'm going there. So, our goal would be to try to create full autonomy, but then it's difficult when you get into electronics. There's so much kind of like the stuff like I mentioned about mining. But what we did do in TIC is that...
To my comment on Boyle is that he's using wood to burn, which is right. The biggest fine dust producer. So if everybody would go back to wood stoves, the pollution would also go haywire.
Sure. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I believe he uses a pencil to write his articles for The Guardian.
Yeah, he does. He writes letters.
Yeah. And that's... and paper, and paper has been a massive, speaking about Colombia earlier on, paper production was a huge driver of conflict in Colombia. Any Irish listeners would know who I'm referring to, but I don't say any names right now. So anyway, TIC created a kind of an insurance fund where we asked the users to give like a seriously minimal amount of money more per month into the collective, so that if one community has a technical problem, there's a fund that they can hopefully quickly replace the equipment with, and we deal with it as we can, which usually means dumping it in the trash and buying another one, because these things are mostly not repairable. Figuring out some way to recycle those electronics, I suppose. I mean, there's quite a stack of lightning-struck equipment. And at this end, we also developed techniques to protect equipment. So we haven't lost anything to lightning, I think, at least in the last year, which is obviously your goal. You don't want to be destroying this terribly expensive electronic equipment. Not in terms of the money. I think, most of the communities can pay off the cost of the base station installation now within about a year, and then it's up to them to decide what they do with the money, what kind of community projects they put it into. But we don't want to be destroying things that are built out of copper and gold and silicon and other things that are being extracted with high cost to humanity. So, I don't know what else I can say about money. Do you want to know anything about specifics of money? Or not really?
Well, maybe if you have curious how much do these communities pay, and do they pay to Resomatica or
generally the community network operates on a membership basis. So you buy a monthly membership, and the cost of that was originally established around 40 Mexican pesos, which is more or less 2 euros a month.
Per family.
Per person, per phone, per phone line number that they want to activate in the system. They pay 2 euros a month. The insurance on top of that was another 2 pesos, which is like, 50 cents? Okay. No, 5 cents. Sorry, 5 cents. And for those 2 euros a month, they get voice calls within their local network, voice calls to any of the other villages that are connected to the community network, and SMS messages between them. Unfortunately, because we outsource the connection to the PSTN, if they want to call the United States, we have to pay that. So we have to charge them the rates for that. The incoming calls are free, but we actually pay for that. And depending on capacity, and we've actually recently been donated some capacity by a company in Mexico City. I mean, that's getting really into the specifics of it, but just trying to figure out those things, At one point, the incoming calls actually started costing us a lot of money because, well, costing Tick a lot of money because the people are obviously preferring to receive calls than make them because, you know, like anybody, you know, why pay when you can have it for free, except for it's not for free because for the organization, it was actually costing more for the incoming call than the outgoing call. So, you know, we had some discussions about doing things like, say, offer, you know, some kind of unlimited outgoing call thing for, I don't know, you know, some other figure per month, where it might make sense for people to make more outgoing calls. Yeah, because so yeah,
it's interesting to hear because it makes it very concrete in how you can relate to this network as well. Yeah. Also, where do the costs go for the organizations?
Okay, yeah, you do that. So that from the 40 pesos, I think the deal was that 35% of that goes to Tick, and the other percentage stays in the community. That's may or may not be negotiable at this point. I mean, it's up to, because Tick is now an assembly-based organization with all these communities, they actually decide that stuff now. You know, Rhizomatica's role has always been to try to stay as a grassroots or based organization where we don't go to communities and say, hello, do you want a mobile network? They have to come and say, you know, that we think we want this. Can you tell us what it is? And then try to, as honestly as possible, say it's going to work like this. And explain to them that we're not a mobile phone operator, that we're not just going to come and then their phone is going to work in the community. They're not going to have the same number that they have with the incumbent telco company. That's going to be a community initiative, and they're going to need to take on the responsibility for administering and ensuring and basically, you can say, having ownership of the network, right? So
It's really interesting to hear, also to expand from the internet and really think of it in a wider sense and how it's really interesting. And can we make a poster with the bummer?
Oh, right, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's, but you would probably want to credit Lanier with it.
Yeah, maybe we can use the same.
Do you want me to write it?
Do we need another color? No.